Hi, today's April 29th, 2017. This is Mobius Podcast number 204. I'm Todd Ogasawaard, my good friend John Westfall, and today we have a very special guest, Ryan Ozawa, who I've wanted on the podcast for a long time, but he is such a busy guy, we have not been able to sync a schedule up until literally today. And we have discussed
Aloha.
Wow. Hey, Ryan.
So Hi, John.
I have a whole bunch of questions for Ryan,
who is
a very well-known technologist in the state of Hawaii, and probably and elsewhere, I should say. But I want to lead off with a couple of quick items that interest some of us, at least. One, a sign that the world is going to end soon, Microsoft Visual Studio for Mac has been released in preview mode. It's really the Xamarin tool ported over and given a new name. But still, having something named Microsoft Visual Studio on a Mac, I think is a sign of the end of the world. It's a sign of end times.
No, it won't be that bad until Xcode comes to Windows. That's when it's the end of time.
That's when you know it's cats and dogs living together in mass hysteria. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
The next item is not a sign of end of times, but it's amusing to me. And that is apparently, while a number of the folks in executive branch of the federal government have employee cards with smart chips embedded in them, Senate employees have a picture of a smart chip on their identification card. So it just looks like they have secondary authentication with them. And I don't know.
That is the most awesome thing I've read all week about our government. You know, you have that, plus you have the president admitting that he realizes his job is hard.
Well,
I mean, that was those two things together just restore my faith that our democracy is running as abnormally as usual.
Yeah, and
I know if you've heard the phrase security theater. Well, that's it comes to us from the federal government. So obviously, a picture of a SIM card is just as good as an actual chip in your card.
So while we try to be apolitical on this show, mostly, I thought this was like nonpartisan stupidity. So,
yep, that is true.
So anyway, had to mention. I read that in Ars Technica, by the way, and so I trust Ars Technica. They're not a fake news site, are they? I don't think.
No, and I think you know frustration with government services at all levels is definitely a cross-partisan issue. Right. Very quickly on the Microsoft one, I forgot to mention. I think that Microsoft is smart because they do, they're acquiring and you know getting quality products built by other people for those platforms. I think that the Outlook app on iOS is actually one of the better mail apps out there. Of course, they didn't build it; they bought it. But I'm glad that they're embracing these platforms.
Yeah, actually, Microsoft has done a real good job since Satya Nadella came on board as CEO of extending their support for non-Windows platforms. You know, so the Android has a lot of good Microsoft apps as iOS, as you mentioned. So, I should mention one more thing before we continue on is you may hear some sounds every now and then. There are three reasons. One, we are in the middle of a flash flood watch, and so the wind is starting to gust. So you may hear stuff behind me making noise. Two, John's birds are actually kind of quiet this morning, but every now and then they really do not like what we're talking about. And they will chime in and let us know with no uncertainty. Right, John?
Oh, yeah.
And three, Ryan, as a busy mobile guy, is in a Starbucks. So every now and then you'll hear something, but quite frankly, it's been really good. I think he's muting it. That's why.
Yeah, it's not bad. When they run the, when they're making the shakes and things, that's when I got to turn it off.
Right. Okay, so the first, and you know, actually, let's just let it run. It's not a big deal. It gives us ambiance, you know, makes it sound like we're all talking.
Natural sounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the first thing Ryan noted before we get to actually talking about him is this Uber story. So Uber apparently, or Uber CEO, got dressed down by Apple CEO for using private FBI private APIs to fingerprint their use even after you delete the app. That's pretty nasty. Yep. That's pretty nasty. Now, John, you said you found this extra amusing. Why is that?
Well, you know, Uber as a company seems to project an image, and of course this is led by leadership, of really not caring about how much they disrupt things. Yeah. And in general, that's their goal. And I thought it was just an interesting sort of realization in the world that Uber relies on being in the Apple App Store. If tomorrow Uber was off iPhones, Uber would be having quite a lot of problems with their revenue streams. So it was a nice reminder that there are some checks and balances in the corporate world where you can be a renegade, but if you annoy the wrong people by geofencing around their headquarters so that your app behaves differently when your when their testers are using it versus when everyone else is using it, that, you know, eventually Tim Cook will get you in his office and have a strong conversation about it.
Now, so I have a different point of view of it, and I know how I'll ask.
Okay.
Ryan, how he thinks about it. I think they got away with it. If you and I had developed an app that did the same thing, we would have had our app booted. But because Uber is Uber, they're kind of too big to kick out, Tim Cook just slapped the hand and said, okay, go on your way, be a good boy now.
Yep, I'm on Todd's side. I think that's why he got the personal one-on-one drubbing from Tim Cook, but the app didn't go anywhere. I think also if Apple ever got into a fight with Facebook, it's not going to be a fight that Apple automatically wins, because a lot of people see their iPhones as basically a window into Facebook and not anything else.
Right.
So Uber, I think it's not too big to fail, but it's definitely too big to treat like a small app. What I thought was interesting was that the feature that they developed was actually to stop fraud, but to get that fraud fighting measure done, to track to make sure people weren't reusing phones to do fake referral codes, that they got in trouble for breaking the rules, and it's breaking the rules that they're known for. So that's how this whole episode is going to be remembered.
Yeah, I agree. And I know Ryan is a, I don't know if I'd call you a fan of Uber, but you've certainly used the service. You've appreciated the service. I don't know, John, if you have used it. I have not used it out of principle.
Mm-hmm. I prefer Lyft. I absolutely prefer Lyft. But you know, I do both.
Yeah.
I have used Uber. I haven't actually, since I live in the middle of nowhere, I think we had one Uber and Lyft driver for a while in my little 15,000 resident town. Yeah, they were. But, you know, I agree that the littler apps would have just been booted. But there are ways that Apple can throw their weight around to Facebook and Uber that I don't think, they are just not always readily apparent. You know, I think about Facebook doing bi-weekly updates and Uber trying to do updates. You got to believe that they get priority review, and those reviews could always take longer as a way of saying, look, we're looking at you a little bit closer. So yeah.
That's true.
Okay, so next on Ryan's bucket list of stuff he wanted to talk to us about is Facebook going big into AR, augmented reality as a platform, and trying to kill Snapchat over and over. Now, Ryan, you know, I know that Facebook bought Oculus Rift, but what else are they doing? I haven't really, I guess, tracked that.
Well, it's a little old news. About 2 weeks ago, they had their annual F8 Developers Conference, and a significant portion of that presentation, or at least one of the two keynote days, was about their trying to become a platform for augmented reality. That's interesting for a couple of things. One, a lot of people are thinking about virtual reality, where you have to cover your eyes and disappear into this world. Augmented reality is much more interconnected with what is actually present in your world. So I think I've always thought that would be the better place to start, rather than making people wear goggles where you're completely blind to the real world. The other thing is they're trying to be a platform, which is always the smarter play. You don't want to create the app that does an AR thing. You want to be the platform on which other people build their big AR ideas, and they're going to be doing it through the camera in their app. So the same way you can plug into Facebook to authenticate users in your app or find your friends across a network, they're basically saying use our camera and the way that we can identify objects on screen to do your augmented reality tricks.
Okay,
so I think it's a big play.
So Oculus Rift, which Facebook bought, is VR. It's, you know, you're kind of blind to the world. So what did they announce any glasses or anything at
FA? No. I mean, so that's why I think it's smart. They're basically saying we're going to use the camera on the device.
Oh, okay.
We're going to do our image processing to identify objects. You can, I don't know, do Snapchat like things and attach emojis to people's faces as they move around. But, you know, they're going to be doing it that way rather than actually developing the apps that do it.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, you know, AR is not new. I mean, I remember 7-8 years ago, there were a couple of iPhone apps that basically let you use its camera to look out in the world, and it would identify nearby things and that sort of thing. So, but it really never took off.
One of the first was Yelp. You know, you could supposedly turn your phone to the side and look, point it down a street and see signs illustrated for all the stores along there.
Right.
But yeah, it's not a big thing for sure.
Yeah, but I think that it could be big. I mean, I always thought AR should be a lot more popular than it, well, never became. But
right, right. Well, gee, like 3D movies or 3D TVs.
I love that, you know, and it never, none of it ever caught on. I even bought a 3D camera. But
oh, my.
Yeah. Yeah, with two lenses and the whole thing. And next up, the new Samsung stuff coming out. And as you say, whatever the heck Apple's going to release in the fall, presumably. I don't know. People keep saying iPhone 8, but shouldn't be a 7S? I don't know.
Well, I know. I think John talked about this on your previous show, at least for the Galaxy. My coworker got it, and even the 7, you know, I think it was a beautiful piece of hardware. He had the Note 7, though, and yeah. He held on to that as long as he could until actually my boss made him return it because it was an insurance liability for him to bring it into the office,
oh, that's
believe
funny.
It or not.
That is funny, actually.
So he had to return it. But I really think Samsung's making some really beautiful hardware. I cannot stand their software, so I would never get a Samsung phone. I'm more a fan of maybe LG if you do the pure Android or obviously the Google Pixel line. But in terms of just looks, I definitely give Samsung points on that. But when you're talking about what Apple has been announced, I am such a big skeptic of this iPhone 8 talk. I am 99% convinced myself that what you're going to get is the 7S.
Yeah.
And all of this talk about the 10th anniversary special super phone with the curved screen and transparent whatever and bezel and whatever, that's all fantasy land. I don't know where all of these supply chain leaks are coming from. It just seems ridiculous to me.
Yeah, well, we'll find out, I guess, this fall if they stick to their schedule. And, you know, like, I agree with you. You know, they've been on a TikTok schedule since the 3.3S, so I can't imagine. Have they ever skipped it? No, they've never skipped it, the TikTok, once the 3.3S started.
No, and, you know, we've gotten very used to Apple leaks that you can tell which ones Apple is behind and which ones Apple is not behind. And the things that we'll hear kind of screaming loud and clear, I don't think we've started to hear those yet. Those are the things that usually around WWDC, you start getting these things. You're like, okay, that was when we started hearing hot and heavy that the audio jack was being removed and stuff like that. So it's all too scattershot right now. It's a lot of dreaming and a lot of cool things, if they're even technologically possible. But then there's a lot of things that, you know, okay, Touch ID is going to get removed because it won't look right.
Oh,
I'm thinking that's not going to happen.
Put it on, in the back, which...
Yeah, it's going to go on the back. And I'm thinking,
which Samsung
yeah,
did, and it's horrible.
Yeah, well, we had a Windows Mobile device years ago, I think, that tried to do that, like a back button or something like that.
Oh, I don't remember that one.
I remember these back buttons have popped up over mobile in the last, you know, 15 years at random times, and they've never actually been something people like. So, well, it's too early to tell. We'll know more in a few months. I am kind of less skeptical because Apple has surprised us all before with strange things, but I think we will definitely see a 7S and a 7S Plus.
Yeah.
But I don't know what else we will see. There could be a third crazy weird device of some sort.
The only thing I could see that would fit in that space is if they did what they did with the MacBook and they said, this is the iPhone and this is the iPhone Pro, you know, getting rid of the Air and fine line that way. But I still think it's weird. I mean, Ming-Chi Kuo, the analyst, has said that Apple was going to release a TV for like 10 years and it never came out. So you can wish all you like, but I agree with John that it's only when the actual devices start rolling off assembly lines that Chinese people can sneak off and take pictures of that we're going to really know what we're going to get.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, and speaking of Apple, this is something near and dear to my heart, actually. Again, part of Ryan's list is the Apple self-drive, or actually, any Apple car, self-driving or not. So I saw an article a day or two ago that a Lexus outfitted with LiDAR and other accoutrements of self-driving cars, presumably from Apple, has been spotted driving around Cupertino, so they're still testing it. Although, didn't they just... like let go of like a couple hundred people from that project. So Project Titan, I believe it's called. So I wonder what's going on there. Cause I have an aging car in my garage right now that needs to be replaced someday, but still running. And I've been waiting for an affordable self-driving car or an unaffordable Apple self-driving car. So I don't know. What do you think, Ryan?
Well, I think that I saw that same article, the photos of the Lexus. I thought it was interesting that they said that the source didn't want to be identified. Because obviously, if I saw something like that on the road and I was a random person, I'd right. say, sure, say it came from me. So I presume it was somebody who might have been affiliated with the company who knew it was going to basically come out of that garage and drive around. Right. What was key about it, though, was that it was using off-the-shelf, existing, commercially available sensors and mounts and all of that, cameras. So when you heard about the reshuffling and the letting go of a lot of people in the Project Titan project, I presume that was them giving up on actually making the car, and now they're basically working on the technology that they could strap on to, you know, let's say here comes the Toyota Titan with the Apple self-driving technology rather than an Apple vehicle. Right. I think it's exciting. And when people say, oh sure, like they're starting so late, and even Apple is going to get into AR, or even Apple is going to do an Amazon Alexa-like device, all I have to do is point to what they're doing with Apple Maps, and that they already have their own street view and their own 3D models. I mean, the stuff that they're doing with maps, catching up to where Google is in one-third the time it took Google to get where it is today, that tells me that they have the capability and the resources to come out of the gate with something that they're keeping secret for now.
Yeah, and historically, Apple has always come from behind, starting with the Mac, actually, right? Because it came after the PC. The iPod came after the MP3 player. Awful MP3 players, of which I bought one or two before I saw an iPod and could not afford it, but waited until I could. And even a tablet. I mean, Microsoft's tablet came out in 2001, that period. And the iPad didn't come out till 10 years later, in 2010. So, you know, they don't mind taking their sweet time in producing something they think is acceptable as a product from them. Now, they've had some really bad ones, but still, you know, Apple socks comes to iPod socks comes to mind, and they're high-fiving.
I will advance a conspiracy theories view of this, that they did kill the project, but the car has remained sentient. And so it goes out for a drive every so often.
Yeah, it feels itself
up. It's not a rogue.
Yeah, the guy who did take a picture of it, he's no longer with us. The car just took care of him. So that is another interpretation of what Apple is really going on. Cupertino's
a mini episode of Conspiracy Views brought to you by John. Thank you. And also, Ryan mentioned, you know, wondered about a Siri speaker, which I assume he means is like an Echo type of device or a Google Home.
Exactly.
And I kind of wonder about that, too. I mean, that one, they're really late to the game. But the problem for them there is not being late to the game, in my opinion. The problem there is something that's actually a good thing, and that's Apple has done a lot, I think, or at least they've said they've done a lot, to protect our privacy. But in doing so, they don't know a lot about it, like Google does and Amazon does.
Right.
So that would be their problem point, their pain point in trying to launch something. Unless they, you know, kind of go against their corporate policy and start consuming our personal information to build up a meta profile of us.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's why they will always be kind of not as advanced. I mean, you can look at what they're doing now with the new iPhones and iOS 10 and the ability to do facial recognition. And you can attach a name to the picture. I can attach a picture. A name to your picture, Todd, and it'll find you in all of my photos and even in videos, but it's not something that can be easily exported or shared or taken advantage of outside of my device, because the whole idea is it's my device, so they're going to keep all the information there and not send it to the cloud where other people can get to it. But on the other hand, you know, as weird as it is, I mean, we have Alexa in our house, and I think it's magical. But in terms of the everyday consumer and the millions and millions of people who use Siri, even when they hate Siri, they use Siri. So I think it's going to come naturally to that user base if they came up with a little box that sits in your house, like an Echo, or if they basically finally turned on a microphone in an Apple TV and had it be able to work in a similar way.
That's a frightening thought, actually.
Well, and I think what actually Apple has that's a little bit of a trick up their sleeve is they've had now for a couple of years family support, where you can have a family unit and, you know, kids can buy things with parental approval, all that stuff. That's where I think the existing speakers have had trouble, is that one person sets them up. And, you know, in our house, we have an Alexa Dot, and everyone knows that it's on my account and it's just my wife and I. But if, you know, someone buys something or something like that, there's no personalization per user.
Right.
And I could see Apple coming out and saying, okay, Apple TVs now ship with Siri. Well, they already do, but they ship with a more powerful version of Siri. And Siri will figure out who in your family is talking to it. So that when someone says, you know, I want to buy this content or I want to do this and that, if it's a child, then the parent gets a notification for approval. If it's an adult, then it goes, you know, those sorts of little customizations that honestly are why I don't really think Google Home or Echoes are really useful for larger groups of people other than just one or two people. A family, I could see, would have issues with anything other than basic like home automation or things like that with Echo and Google Home.
And I can see Siri actually responding, you know, if it knows the ages of children in your home. And, you know, let's say you have a little 7-year-old Timmy in your home and Timmy tries to order Game of Thrones. Siri may just come back and say, I'm sorry, Game of Thrones is not appropriate for a 7-year-old. You
know? Or if Timmy says, you know, send Game of Thrones to my iPad, then it won't happen. But if, you know, Dad says send Game of Thrones to my iPad, then when Dad next loads up his iPad, it's sitting there already downloaded and ready to go.
Right.
No, actually, family support is a good point, John. And I think that when you look at how, you know, I think Alexa is being designed to recognize all voices, which is good, and but has the downside that it can't differentiate. Whereas, obviously, even on the Siri side, it's designed so that if I say it to my phone will respond to me. But if Todd tries to talk to my phone, it won't respond to him. So you're right. No. That is a differential.
Actually, Siri doesn't respond to me on my iPhone. So it has gotten progressively dumber, in my opinion. It used to work great right after Apple bought them and integrated them into the iPhone. You know, I would be playing podcasts and say pause, stop, all that kind of stuff. But the last couple of updates, I think starting with 8.0 or 9.0, it just hasn't recognized anything I say, and I've kind of given up using it.
That's interesting. I've used it a lot, and my favorite upgrade was their most recent one, where you can even tell it to execute actions within apps that Apple did not design, which is, of course, something the original app did before they bought it. But the fact that they brought it back is exciting. I send money to my coworkers all the time just using my voice.
Wow, you know, it's some money to us.
Yeah, I want to be one of your coworkers now.
Well, you'll just have to send me your cash or Venmo username.
Any rate, I wanted to get to actually talking to Ryan about Ryan. So I've known Ryan, gosh, how long have you known Ryan? 12, 15 years, something like that, I think.
I would think at least that, somewhere in the 90s.
it's been a while. So in our fair state and elsewhere, Ryan is known as a... Gosh, I'm not sure what you're not a well. You are kind of
total an entrepreneur, weirdo.
But you are a champion of entrepreneurs. And in fact, you and your a tech partner in crime, Bert Lum, recently won an award, right? For
For being the cheerleader of the tech community, which I thought was an award they just made up to give to us so that we would like leave them alone. But it turns out it has actually been around. So that was good.
And part of the way they do that is they host a weekly science and tech show on public radio here in Hawaii. How long has that been going on?
Heading into our 9th year. Yeah. Wow. And then for almost 5 years, we've been doing a segment on Hawaii News Now, which is the joint CBS-NBC affiliate here, morning shows, where we just do more consumer tech, very short, quick bits, versus the public radio show, which is half an hour.
Right. And on your public radio show, you often bring on guests, and actually almost always have guests.
Yes, it's always guests.
So it's a very interactive show in that sense. You also have call-ins and things like that. So if you happen, did you switch stations? I mean, there are two public broadcast stations.
Yep.
And you're in the other one now?
Yeah, we're on the HBR one. They just on Valentine's Day, they reorganized their stream so that all the classical music was on one station. They used to kind of mix it around, and now all of the talk and news is on one side and all of the classical music is on the other.
That kind of makes sense, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, 5 p.m. Wednesdays, Hawaii time, and you also do a podcast. I mean, not a podcast, You turned it into an audio file
that is
a podcast. Okay, so I've known Ryan for a pretty long time, and one of the things I've always said about him is I kind of follow him around, sometimes literally, just to see what he's doing. Because it's always a preview of what I might be doing later. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, about how you got started. How did you develop your interest in this? I know that you're a journalism major, so maybe that's part of it. But, you know, how did you develop an interest in not just interest in technology, but early technology? I mean, before the rest of us really even pay attention to it.
Sure. And I know that you mentioned that John and I have this in common, kind of an interest in being an early adopter in mm-hmm. some cases. I trace it. I mean, my love of technology is not uncommon, and I definitely am a geek and like new toys like anyone else. I'd like to say, if I pretend to find a deeper meaning to it, is it's about specifically connecting with people that I find attractive. Mm. My start with it was discovering dial-up bulletin boards when I was in intermediate school and launching my own without telling anybody or getting my parents' permission, hooking up a computer to my phone line and telling people that they could only call between 10 p.m. and like 6 a.m. But of course, that didn't work because people would call all the time and it would make the phone ring in the house and drive my parents nuts. So they ended up letting me get a second line to the house so I could have a full-time line for the BBS. And, you know, the rest is history, I think. So before the broad internet, it was still using technology to make friends with other people, leave messages, trade files. I just thought that was really cool. Then Usenet, which was sort of like a text-only internet, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and then all the way up through the web and putting my first web page on the internet. Oh, wait, Gopher Space. I published a page on Gopher in 92, I think, and then my first web page in 94. But it's all about connecting with people. It's all about telling stories. Mm-hmm. And so the technologies that excite me the most, which today you would call social media, we're all about that kind of expressing yourself, documenting things. And yes, journalism is a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to express it. I never really thought about that about you, but yeah, you really are always about communications and interaction, not just communication. Because communications can be one way, like radio or TV, which is mostly one way, newspapers, but you're always about multi-way communication, not even just two-way.
Well, I think community is the word. Oh, yeah, go ahead, John.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting kind of comparing, because I've been accused of being an early adopter in the past, and rightfully so. And I think that for me, early adopting was always about trying to channel some sort of superhuman ability, you know, something that other people looked at and went, wow, that's cool that can do that. So that was why I jumped into pocket PCs and smartwatches and, you know, back in the 90s, just having, you know, your own domain and having an email address that wasn't at Hotmail or something like that. So it's interesting that you can have early adopters. I've never really given too much thought about the psychology of early adopting, which is interesting since I'm a psychologist. But it is interesting that for Ryan, it was connection with other people. For me, it was how can I live my life in a more cool, efficient, sort of productive, mm-hmm. have these abilities way, and then, you know, see these things that I've been doing for years show up in the mainstream later, usually a lot easier and a lot less buggy than the way I was doing them. So kind of a cool difference in motivations.
Oh, well, I guess I should add mine, and mine is not quite as admirable, I guess, as yours. Mine is because I'm lazy. And I am always in search of something to just get rid of something I'm doing, you know, some task or a series of tasks or just something I don't like to do and automate the heck out of it. I haven't done it for everything. Like, I haven't automated feeding the pets. But, you know, that should actually be easy to do.
Wait, that's possible. Like that exists.
Yeah, yeah. Buy that. But in any case, that's pretty cool. And, you know, I remember some of the things you tried early on that just boggled my mind. I mean, not that it was technically super hard to do, but just the fact you did it. Like, I remember when you carried a laptop with a giant extra battery in a backpack and live-streamed video, like Justin TV. In fact, I think it was right after he started.
Yes, it was inspired by Justin TV. Again, you see something that somebody's doing and it's very compelling to you. There was a guy in San Francisco who started live-streaming his everyday life, like, including walking into the supermarket or walking into the bathroom, and you could just sort of watch this video streaming from his hat. And I thought, well, that was interesting. And the first thing I did is I started a blog called the Justin TV Guide. And
I don't remember that one.
Basically blogged the things that he did that was actually interesting, because you didn't want to always just watch him, you know, napping.
Right.
And then when that was going on, I said, how can I do that? So yes, with a EVDO modem hooked up to USB to a laptop in my backpack and a camera strapped to my shoulder, I tried to do the exact same thing.
Right.
The upside was I lived in Hawaii, so some of the things I would go to and see was more interesting to some people than maybe a San Francisco bar. But on the other hand, I was a geeky dad, and a lot of my streams were me yelling at my kids, so that was probably that.
Well, the thing I remember is that, as you say, we live in Hawaii where it's, you know, almost always over 80 degrees. And you had this heat-generating laptop and battery on your back. And I remember you were just really hot all the time when you had that on.
Yeah, it was definitely not an efficient setup. And, of course, now we can do it with our phones. I like what John said, what, you know, back when you, it was weird to have your own domain name. I think he and I are in common in one way. We remember when domain names were free. But also that at that time, it never occurred to me that maybe I should pick up a few. So I just missed that whole boat. Like, wow, I keep thinking, wow, what domain names would I own today if I just went through that process when it was free? But it just didn't occur to me that that would be something to have or to do. But it's just a cool technology. You mentioned your pocket PC. I was definitely a Palm Pilot guy. Mm-hmm. I would get all of the PDA style phones, the Nokia M71 or whatever it was, which had its own camera and keyboard and could do live streaming itself. And again, that was very early days. Getting like you, I think, Todd, doing things that seem superhuman was also certainly a motivation. Something that you could do with tools that used to require an entire truck, you could now do with something you could carry in a backpack.
Right. Right. And, you know, another thing related to that, as you moved on in technology and through time, you also put mounted a camera on your dashboard. And I remember you used to do live streaming and talking to people as you were driving to work. Are you still doing that, by the way? I don't think so.
Oh, no. Yeah. That probably was not a good idea. And it's very repetitive, you know. A commute is already boring enough for the person who's doing it, but to watch someone else do it is kind of insane, actually. But then again, now there's a huge industry watching other people play video games, so what do I know?
Yeah.
But that was fun because people would just sort of watch where they lived or where they used to live as I drove past and go like, there, he just passed my old apartment building.
Yeah.
But that was pretty much the extent of the entertainment value of it.
Right. And of course, you were just one... The one thing you missed on, the only thing you missed on that, was turning the camera around with a guest and doing these car things, you know, like carpool karaoke, okay, without the singing. But, I mean, I guess you could do that too, but...
Jerry Seinfeld's car interviews and all of that. Definitely, I think if I had more interesting people than myself to drive around, that's probably actually what would have happened.
Okay, now, the one thing I did want to get to is... something you inspired me to do, and that's do podcasts. So we're on podcast number 204.
But amazing.
You are super famous in the podcast world because you had one of the most popular podcasts around back in the day when Lost, the TV show, was on. You want to talk about how you got started? Because you got started in podcasting a couple of years before me, I think.
That's right.
2008.
Oh, it was 2004 for us.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was inspired by, you know, Bert Lum and his monthly geek meetup group here, mm-hmm, called Bite Marks. And you and I would go, Paul Lawler, I'm trying to remember who else was there. And one day it was Bob Liu who came and said, hey, have you heard of this thing called podcasting? And he was listening to Adam Curry. And we were like, well, how do you do it? He said, well, all you have to do, which are famous last words, all you have to do is record a file, place it on the internet, connect it, attach it to an RSS feed with an enclosure thing, which is a new thing, which isn't standardized, and maintain this feed. And then all of a sudden people could set up a piece of software that runs overnight and goes out and gets all of these files. And then it copies it to your MP3 player and you can listen to it. That's all you have to do. It's so simple. It's going to be simple. But we, being the geeks that we were, we jumped into it. So yeah, I started a podcast about Hawaii. And probably a year into that, Lost started filming in Hawaii, the ABC hit television series. And I started talking about running into their filming around town. And there was this sudden intersection of people who were listening to my show because of the Hawaii stuff and people who were listening because of the Lost scoops. And the people in each camp were getting sick of hearing about the other stuff. So Lost fans didn't want to hear about me and my kids in the spam jam. And the Hawaii people were getting sick of hearing about Lost. So I spun it off. And when it comes down to being in the right place at the right time, that's what happened, because Lost was one of the first TV shows that Apple allowed you to purchase on iTunes because of the relationship with Disney.
Right.
So there's Steve Jobs on stage saying, okay, guess what? This new version of iTunes will allow you to buy TV shows like, hey, Lost. And this new version of iTunes will also bring you this newfangled weird thing called podcasting. And we think this is going to be big. And so this is a, you know, democratized media. So why don't you guys try it out? So by sheer chance, I credit Steve Jobs and iTunes 100%. The same day that that new version of iTunes came out, my servers crashed and stayed down for weeks. Because I personally think that because iTunes is also a horrible piece of software, you would go to iTunes, you'd say, I want to find out about this thing called Lost, and what you would get is my podcast.
So
people discovered us that way. We were number 6 or 7 of all podcasts in the system for a long time, like right up there with ESPN and all of these national brands. And there's this Ryan and Jen, my wife and I, talking about Lost. So that was amazing. That was a crazy time this year.
Right. And I should note, for people who don't know, when you subscribe to a podcast through iTunes, you are not hitting Apple servers. You are hitting whatever server the RSS feed is pointing at. So, you know, I have a podcast service that I pay for on an annual basis, and that's where this podcast is streaming from, in the 5s and occasionally 10s. Ryan, on the other hand, had like tens of thousands of podcast. Well, maybe more. I don't know. Ryan, do you know how many listeners you had at your peak?
At the peak was probably about 40,000.
Wow.
A week. So that was pretty cool.
Right.
But that was also not good for my web hosting bill. Right.
But, and this is well over 10 years ago. So you might say, well, 40,000, yes, yeah, that's nice. No, 40,000 was huge back then.
That was a significant number. Part of the market, because how many people were even listening to podcasts as a thing?
Right.
Right. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Other thing I should notice, since we're talking about Apple, Bob Liu, who I did not know Bob inspired you to do podcasts, Ryan. Bob.
Oh, it was a specific day at that lunch. We were at the YWCA on Richard Street.
Yeah.
And he told us all about it. Yeah.
That's funny, because as you know, Ryan, Bob was one, I think, Apple employee number one in Hawaii. Okay, folks, sorry about that. I lost power momentarily. We are under a flash flood watch?
I think it's watch.
Advisory, something not too high level, but apparently our electrical company is having problems dealing with the winds or something.
Famous Hawaii infrastructure.
Yeah. But we won't criticize them too much. There's lots of reasons why it's like that. But anyhow, what we're talking about was our mutual, Ryan's and my mutual friend Bob Liu, who inspired Ryan to do his podcast back in 2004. So that's 13 years ago. Wow. And the thing is that Bob was, I think, Apple employee number one in Hawaii. If he wasn't Apple employee number one, he was pretty darn close to it. He retired years ago. But and the other amazing thing about this story, I think, I believe, although Bob has been a huge advocate of podcasts and I think taught some courses at a community college or something somewhere, I don't think he's ever recorded one.
That was the joke. We would come back to the lunch and we would talk about all the podcasts we were doing. And probably within a year, there were 7 or 8 podcasts in that group of people.
Yeah.
And we're like, Bob, when is your podcast coming out? He goes, I'm working on it. I don't think you're right. I don't think you ever put one out, despite inspiring so many other people to do it.
Now, you know, the kind of last two things I wanted to ask you about are Twitter, where you are a verified user, as I recall. And,
that happened.
And you had an interesting experience recently. And again, we try to be apolitical, but in this case, we just can't. But because it involves you, I'm going to mention it. Your Twitter account, which is, I guess I can say it to our 5s of the listeners, at Hawaii, got hit hard. Can you tell us why?
Well, I
think you hit CNN too, right? You were mentioning CNN.
It happens quite a bit because I'm crazy enough to want the username Hawaii on services. Every so often, I am tagged in conversations about the state and place rather than people who have any idea who the heck I am. So usually it's when maybe a tsunami is coming where I suddenly get people mentioning Hawaii, or when Zac Efron, I don't know, Kylie something or other is in Hawaii as a vacation, and TMZ is covering it, I get mentioned. But the biggest one, obviously, was a couple of months ago when a federal judge here in Hawaii issued a stay on President Trump's immigration ban. And that caused quite a bit of an uproar, with people either thanking the state of Hawaii, or more likely and more common, cursing the state of Hawaii. And if they used at Hawaii as their way to do that, would fill my mention streams with thousands of random messages. So it was very, very weird week.
Right. And as I said earlier, I remember you were actually mentioned on the CNN report about this. Did they interview you?
Just by email, yes, yeah.
Okay.
And certainly, obviously, the local news, public radio station on the West Coast. I mean, it was a tempest in a teapot. There is so much outrage now. I mean, the internet outrage machine existed prior to this current administration, but I believe it has now reached its apex of performance. That fortunately, everything that everyone's mad about, we're only mad about it for a day or two. So that's
yeah.
Really good. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention, since we were talking about podcasting, and that is pod fading. The other thing you're famous for is pod fading. I remember I saw your photo on the top page of Wired.
It was Wired, yeah.
When you and Jen said, okay, we're done with this podcasting thing. How was that 15 or minutes or 15 days of fame for you?
That is weird to be known for stopping something more than you are for starting something. But it was, as I mentioned, how crazy it was when our podcast took off. Just like with a poor doctor on an airplane, everyday people aren't prepared to be the focus of attention of hundreds of, tens of thousands of people. And it just really overwhelmed us. So right as you would think that the Lost podcast was taking off so well that maybe we should start monetizing and finding a way to get rich and all of that stuff, we were just exhausted. We were just burnt out. So very quickly after that breakout success, we said, hey, you know what? I think we're done. And for whatever reason, I think it's human nature. Most people don't leave when they're at the peak. They leave when people are already sick of them. So we had the benefit of nobody realizing how terrible we actually were. There was a great deal of romanticizing about how good our show was and that it was just sad that we were quitting. So now I believe just the term pod fading, you can learn that it's about people who kind of give up podcasting, but very high up in the list of references will sadly be my wife and I giving up our Lost podcast. We only gave up for a little while. We couldn't resist. We love the show too much, and we definitely love the community of the show. But we did have to take that break for sure.
Right. And I should mention that it was not only the fans of the show that enjoyed it. A couple of the stars of the show would provide you with info and that sort of thing, as I recall.
I cannot confirm or deny that I received any inside information from actual cast and crew. I would say that I had a very mixed relationship with the actual production, as in some people were always happy to see me. Other people would call the cops when they saw me. So it was an interesting mix for sure.
Yeah. And one of the things, when there are local shows shooting locally in Honolulu, you see them because we're down there in downtown or wherever they are around, the state. And so it's not unusual. For example, I think Marvel's Inhumans is going to be starting up soon, and they recently covered the statue of Father, I guess now Saint Damien, in front of the state capitol, and it was kind of a monolith with the Inhumans language on it. So that happened.
Right.
I know I ran into who's the star of Hawaii Five-0 plays McGarrett. Can't think of his name. But he was literally in my office building because they were shooting there, So he and the guy who plays Dano, they're all standing around in my office building as I was walking through to a meeting. So those kind of things are not unusual in this state.
Now, I love that shooting.
The interesting thing.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say the interesting thing about that. It's funny that you got in the I love that, because I remember when I worked in New York for 3 years, whenever you would see something happening, you were so, the New York attitude was always, Stupid things happening again. Just get these people out of here. They're just messing things up, you know. Oh, well, you know, the president's coming to town. Great. That's going to snarl up traffic on, you know. This it just it's such an interesting sort of difference of just, oh, great, people again versus it's cool to see. And I kind of wish I wasn't as jaded from the New York experience.
Well, John, I mean, we had a, the previous administration, the president spent a lot of time in Honolulu, and we were very familiar with let's close the freeway for half an hour.
Oh, yeah.
To drive around. And the thing about filming here I love is that the company where I work at, my day job, is Hoy Information Service. It's a tech company. Our actual office, I mean, our actual cubicles appeared in an episode of Lost. So Terry O'Quinn was sitting on the couch in our office. And when the Lost production crew realized that the company that they asked to use the office of was the company where I worked at, they asked me to make myself scarce for the day. So that was kind of fun. But I tell you, when I was doing this for Lost in 2004, 2005, it was really unique. Just like, look at this guy. He's stalking this crew and following them around and all that stuff. But now it's an industry. Now there's it's like TMZ for film crews. It's a thing. So I know that there are people that are following Inhumans around. I was downtown when they closed Bishop Street to do a street scene, and they had like cabs and everything driving down the street that wouldn't normally be downtown Honolulu. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now getting back to Twitter, where again you are at Hawaii, and you're registered. And I never figured out what that meant, by the way, registered or verified user, I guess. Are you still heavy? I mean, I don't see you as much on Twitter as I think I used to. Or maybe my feed is, I'm just not looking at my Twitter feed when you're on it. And I don't scroll back usually, so.
No. Well, first, a couple of things. Twitter now has an algorithmic feed for a lot of people, just like Facebook does. So if you don't engage or we don't interact very often, you're going to see me less often.
And that would be never. So, which is. My Twitter feed should be like zero then, because I don't engage with anybody on Twitter.
I mean, it even pays attention to who you click on and what you search for and stuff. I'm never a fan of algorithmic feeds. I want chronological, but apparently that makes us old. But no, Twitter is still my favorite platform, but I certainly don't. I used to tweet probably 70, 80 times a day. Now I can do maybe 3 a day, and sometimes I can go 3 days without it. So. It is true that it's different than it was back in, 2014, but...
When you started, and this is another one of those things where I would never have gotten a Twitter account if it wasn't for you. You and Bert kept talking about, what is this Twitter thing they keep mumbling about?
Well, people have been predicting the death of Twitter for about 6 years now, so I'm sure it'll be over sometime soon.
Yeah. And so speaking of, you know, again, as I've mentioned, you know, you've kind of inspired me prod is not the right word, you never prodded me, but made me interested in certain things. What things right now that I probably don't know about would you say I should look at?
Wow. You know what? I wasn't prepared for this question. I definitely like to use any new app that comes out. I spend a lot of time on Product Hunt. Product Hunt is sort of the hatching ground for apps. But the problem is I've not played with one recently that's blown my mind, and I delete them pretty quickly too. But I definitely like trying them all. So if you're an early app adopter, Product Hunt is a cool place to hang out.
Good point.
I'd say my primary, the thing that I've been playing with a lot lately is privacy things. You know, I've always been into PGP. People still won't get into PGP because it's complicated to get into PGP. Proton Mail, you know, Telegram or Signal or encrypted messaging apps. I now use a VPN, which I didn't only until this year, which is a very geeky thing to do, but it took me a while to come around. But again, I'd say for no apparent reason, because this is a political podcast, for no reason, I'm very interested in privacy right now.
Yeah, right. There's no particular reason. I understand. And I should note that, you know, John and I have been talking about VPNs and things for a while. And like you, Ryan, I have not subscribed to VPN service until this year. I don't know why.
Yeah, no idea.
Yeah, yeah. But John's been using it for quite a while, so I actually paid for an annual subscription to Private Internet Access, which John recommended to me, I think, well over a year ago.
Yeah, that was what I was looking at. That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's John, their big claim is that they don't log anything, which is what I really like.
Yeah.
So how other what other ways do you use John to hide from unnamed and completely imaginary forces that might be interested in your personal information?
Physically, when he's standing behind me, I'm large enough that you can't see him. So it's, you know, that's an easy way. No, it's interesting. You're talking about things for privacy. Lifehacker released an article this week about Collate, which is a new note platform that is kind of getting there behind basically the idea that you keep your note corpus on your own computer instead of on a web server. So I'm starting to play around with that because, again, that's sort of the same thing as Ryan said. I've been more interested in the security. I've always been interested in information security, but as it applies to people, you know, things like keybase.io, which is, you know, trying to get people to start thinking about PGP and using those things and having my PGP key available. It's just, it's technology that's honestly not that hard to use, but there's still a big stigma around getting it set up, et cetera.
Yeah, usually the more convenient it is, the less secure it is. The more convenient it is to open something, the less secure it is. I'm using Keybase, too. I just saw it as a pretty social key server. You know, before you would have to go to MIT or some really ugly-looking website designed in the 90s to look up keys. So I thought Keybase is pretty. But now they're adding things like chat and file storage. I'm like, uh-oh, feature creep already. And they've only been around for a couple of years. So I'm a little worried about them. But I do like Keybase for sure.
Yeah, I wonder about them too. But we'll kind of see. Hopefully they'll keep their priorities aligned instead of just trying to get 100,000 things going. I think when I log in, I still see invites. So I don't even know if they're open to everyone or if you still need an invite for them yet.
Well, I think you or I are happy to give any listener an invite.
Very, very, very true.
Yep, yep. Okay, I know we've kept Ryan quite a while now, and with our little power outage, it didn't help. Ryan, you got anything you wanted to add? Anything you want to plug that you're doing? Because you do so many things.
I like to keep busy. First of all, Todd and John, thank you for having me on the show. And I know, Todd, we've probably been talking about doing this for 4 years now, or whatever the length of the podcast has been around. And I'm like, oh, we're both in the same city. How hard can it possibly be? But apparently it can be very hard. So I appreciate it. Yeah. I'm glad that you're still podcasting, because believe it or not, I want to podcast again someday.
All right.
But I have to figure out how to get that done. The last thing I wanted to mention is, in addition to my day job at the real estate company, Hawaii Information Service, I also am involved in a startup. I was so excited about covering the startup scene and being a cheerleader, as you say, that I joined a friend and a few friends in starting a company. It's called Smart Yields, and it's an agricultural tech company.
Wow.
And we just released our app, and it's about bringing data science and precision agriculture to everyday people and small farms in particular. So if you grow at home, or you have a greenhouse, or you have a garden, or let's say you might live in certain states where certain plants can be grown that are very high value. we'd love for you to check out our app. So it's called Smart Yields. And we just raised about $500,000 and going for another million now.
Nice.
And it's very exciting to be in that world. And everything that you see on Silicon Valley on HBO is absolutely true.
Nice. And so Smart Yields is iPhone, Android, both?
iPhone right now and web.
Oh, iPhone and web. Got it. Okay, awesome. Smart Yields, plural, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
SmartYields.com. Thank you.
All right. Hey, thanks, Ryan. And by the way, I have to say, you know, for all the sitting in a Starbucks, the ambient sound was not that noticeable to me. And John, are your birds okay? I didn't hear them at all during your podcast.
Yeah, they're over here. They've just been very interested and they've enjoyed, you know, thinking about this podcast, because they can't hear it right now other than me. But, you know, I guess when they're angry, they're only really mad at me because they never hear the other side of it.
Well, I always thought their hearing was superior to ours, so they could hear you through your earbuds. But
that's very
in
possible.
In any case, Mobile Views Podcast 204, Todd Ogasawara, John Westfall, and our special guest, Ryan Ozawa. Thank you so much, Ryan. And we will
talk
to you all next time.